day 18 came, even though I was probably still not 100% enjoying it, I was like, this is what I do. You know, it's like a job, you know, you have a bad day in the office or a really bad day in the office. You don't necessarily quit your job and that's it, not going back. You'll go home, you'll complain, you'll be in a grump, but you'll get up the next day and you go to work. And you just pick away at it, and that's what I did.
Listen Stokely, where we try to be involved, to listen and learn for us all to evolve. So welcome to you and welcome the world. We hope you enjoy the stories to be told.
Welcome to Stokely, a podcast where we explore environmental conservation, our human mindset and adventure. Each week we invite you into a conversation with people from all walks of life, people who truly inspire us and set about contributing to a greater place for us all to call home. So please take some time to settle in for a conversation today with our host, Maya.
Hi everyone, today I get to speak with Donnie Campbell, fresh off roaming the Highlands and the Munros of Scotland. But to be exact, Donnie travelled between and summited all 282 Munros in Scotland in a new record of 31 days, 23 hours and 2 minutes. And he did it all under his own power, kayaking, running, hiking, and cycling to link all of the Munros up. So Munros are mountains of Scotland that are over 3,000 feet, which is just under 1,000 meters. And how Donnie managed to navigate that non-stop in just over 31 days is what we really get into in our conversation. So talk about adventure. Well, Donnie's been on an adventure and we get to hear all about it. Thanks a lot for tuning in today. And I'd like to take a moment to thank and acknowledge the traditional custodians on the lands where this podcast is created and listened to. And I want to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. For me in Melbourne, it's the Boomerang and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Thanks for taking the time today to listen into our conversation and I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, well, you're a professional at interviews, so we should be no worries then. I'm glad I've got the professionals in today, mate. So look, I've just hit record, and we'll just roll into it because we've got a fair bit to cover. We've got a fair bit to chat about, and yeah. I just as I said again, like I really appreciate your time, especially. You know, considering that you're probably, I don't know, what, how are you feeling now after your Munro round? Are you feeling a little bit tired still? Or are you back to normal?
I wouldn't say normal because I cracked my ribs a couple of weeks ago by dismounting my gravel bike by going over the handlebars. I don't recommend coming off a bike by going over the handlebars. That really hurt. So, once I finished, it was like I had images of like being able to stretch, have a hot bath, relax. But the first week was just chaos. It was like getting pulled in so many directions because obviously I coach athletes and I'd been away skiving for 5 weeks from my actual work. So I had all that to catch up with. And then just some media requests and yeah, just kind of cutting grass and getting back to normality, you know. You know, just the normal, just you had to catch up and everything else. So yeah, like for about a week I was just kind of actually working harder, I thought, than when I was in doing the round or like sitting at the desk for 8 hours and going, man, running up and down hills is so much easier than this. Then after that, I kind of got back to normality, time to stretch, time to bath. And then 2 weeks ago, I was out on the bike, went in too fast into a corner. Like I'd cycled this path before, but in a different direction. I forgot how tight the corner was. It was a downhill corner. Yeah, just being an idiot. Went in too fast and went over the handlebars, cut my shoulder, cracked some ribs. So yeah, apart from being a bit sore, which is getting a bit better now, yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, excellent, mate. Yeah. Glad to hear. You're wearing a helmet, I hope. And
yeah, I was wearing a helmet on the bike because I'm stupid. I've got zero bike skills. So like, only took up cycling to actually cycle riding an O-round. And then I kind of enjoyed it, the gravel side of stuff. And I was like, well, take a wee bit of time off from running and do a bit of cycling. And then after crashing again, I was like, yeah, bikes are dangerous. I'm just going to stick to running.
Yeah, yeah. Mate, yeah, I watch a few geez, anything on a bike downhill, like I'm no good at watching it, or I'm no good at doing it. Like I'm more than happy to cycle uphill for hours. And then when it comes to the downhill section, normally I'm just like riding the brakes and just taking three times longer than probably anyone else, probably even longer than a kid who's just like enjoying that fun part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm totally opposite. I get carried away and think, oh, yeah, speed's great. Let's go faster, forgetting I can't actually cycle a bike properly. And you're like, oh, no, this is not great.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Donnie, I find it super interesting because to go on the adventure that you went on, and we'll get to the detail of that in a bit, I've got a feeling that there's quite a lot of people out there who have that inkling or that sense of adventure to want to go and do something like that. And, you know, like cut life off for 5 weeks and go and do it. But quite often that's the point that they can't get over. You know, they're like, I can't leave everything that I have here for 5 weeks because I've got to mow the lawns and I've got to deal with people from work and et cetera, et cetera. How do you justify your sense of adventure like that and actually going out there and doing it?
For this one, it was kind of in the planning. So I've always wanted to climb all the Munros in Scotland. So there's 282 of them. And it's something I've wanted to do. And I thought, like, doing them all in one go would be great. And exactly as you're asking, like, how can I justify taking 5 weeks off work? And to be honest with you, it was basically 12 months of planning as well. You know, I wasn't just planning the round. So last summer, I said to my wife, look, Rachel, want to do this next year. And then I started setting up work, savings, kind of putting things in place that was meant I was going to be able to do it. So, you know, working more remotely, which I'd already been doing, which means I can train during the day and stuff. And then, yeah, just kind of saving up some money. Thankfully, I had a motorhome or a camper van on that. So it's that kind of stuff. And then most of my athletes understand, because it's not like I disappear every month or every 2 months for like 3, 4, 5 weeks, you know, so it's a one-off. So, you know, explaining, you know, what I was doing and how I was going to adapt my coaching for them and building in contingencies if they needed, you know, answering questions, for example. So, you know, what was great for me in a work sense was WhatsApp voice messages, so people could still ask me coaching questions or training concerns, and I could just record an audio and answer their questions, which is really quicker than typing up an email. So it was that kind of thing. You know, it was actually 12 months of sorting my life out that gave me the opportunity to go and take 5 weeks off work. And not everyone's in that situation. You know, some people have got 9-to-5 jobs. So, you know, in that, you've got like micro adventures. I think it was Al Humphreys in the Adventures that kind of coined the phrase micro adventures, which is basically just disappearing for maybe 1 or 2 days. So doing it over a weekend or taking a long weekend. So, you know, people have families, work commitments. So, you know, you don't have to be going off for 5 weeks or travel around the world. You know, you could just go bikepacking, camping, bivvying, or even, you know, there's a guy in Sky, a good friend of mine that does, he's been doing it for almost 2 years now, a bivvy a month. So no matter what he does one bivvy a month. And the photos are stunning, and I think he's on like 50 odd months of making every month from the COVID lockdown, bivvying in his garden just to keep that kind of everyone once a month bivvying out. So yeah, it's pretty cool. You know, you can do lots of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You just mentioned it then, and we'll definitely just bring it to clarity right now, because because it is amazing the mission that you just went on, and I'm gonna have to read it out just so I don't get it wrong, Donnie. So bear with me for a moment here. But we spoke about before. You kind of coin it like the Munro round, or getting around all the Munros. So it's finishing all 282 mountains that are over 3,000 feet or 914 meters in Scotland. And so those mountains are called Munros, and there's 282 of them in Scotland. And so you went around and climbed every single one of those 282 mountains over 31 days, 23 hours, and 2 minutes. And you did it all by joining them either cycling or kayaking. So you did the whole thing human powered, and you achieved, like, you know, I guess setting a new fastest known time or new record for doing that Munro round. Hey, is that, did I get all that spot on, mate?
Yeah, pretty much. There was a bit of crawling as well involved, but yeah, that's pretty much it.
Excellent, mate. Excellent. And I find it so interesting that, you know, you're sitting in your office again and thinking that life's a lot easier when you're climbing up and down mountains, as opposed to getting back to the reality of work when it's busy. But, mate, that whole time out there, 31 days, sounds like you would have been working pretty hard, mate. How many hours a day on average were you out there? How did it work out?
Averaging around about 12 hours a day. Like, some days were a lot longer. So, like, longest day apart from last 2 days was like 16 and a half hours. Some days were 14 hours. But again, some days we'd been about 8, 9, 10 hours. So I'd say I averaged about 12 hours a day. But, you know, there was a lot of suffering and a lot of kind of hard work. You know, kind of a typical day would be up at 5 a.m., breakfast, and then run by 6. And then however long it took me to do that day, whether it was finishing at 6, 7, 8 at night, or finishing at 3, 4 in the afternoon. And then it was basically a matter of recovering, eating as much food as I can, and then crawling to bed at like maybe 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night on that. But looking back, you know, it was a very simple lifestyle that, you know, it was great. Like, you know, I wasn't worried about, you know, money, financial stuff, mortgages. You know, all I had to do was literally get up, run, eat and sleep. You know, Rachel, my wife, was my support group. She was doing amazing. Like, she probably worked as hard as I was working. So, like, I look at it as a team achievement, you know. She was, you know, that's how great it was. Like, you know what it's like when you come home, you do a long run, you've got a vest covered in sweat, covered in sticky gels, and you're like, oh, the last thing I want to do is clean that vest out. Rachel was doing it for me. So, in the next morning, all I had to do was put my vest back on and I was all ready to go. So, you know, small things like that made a massive difference. And, you know, it's just like, yeah, looking back, yeah, I was working hard and I was kind of suffering, but it was probably type 2 kind of suffering, so you enjoy it now. But yeah, it was just such a simple life. It was great, you know.
Yeah, I can feel that, you know, like, I definitely understand what you mean. I think it also needs to be said that over the complete distance that you ended up completing was around about 1,422 kilometers.
Something like that. I keep forgetting the actual numbers because I'm not really into the stats. But yeah, it was equivalent to cycling as well, roughly over 1,000 K or something. So yeah.
When did that idea first spring into your mind? Obviously, you're you're Scottish by birth, and this is something that you've probably seen happen, you know, since like a younger age than what you are now. But when was that first idea first planted? Where's that idea first planted for you to grow from?
That's a hard question. I don't really know specifically. I know it's been on my mind for maybe 4 or 5 years that I've wanted to climb all the Munros in Scotland. And then in that style, I doing them all in one go, human power. So like I said, running, walking, cycling, crawling, kayaking in between, maybe 3 years, 4 years is like when I was like, okay, I kind of want to do all the Munros. And then you kind of look at like previous records on the Munros, you know, you look at who was the first person to complete all the Munros, you know, and then people that ran in between them. And then the most recent records were like self-propelled. So like I said, cycling and kayaking in between. And the record was originally held by Stephen Pikes in 2010, which was 39 days and 9 hours. So that was kind of a benchmark of, okay, that's how I'm going to do it, is I'm going to cycle and kayak. So yeah, it's kind of maybe 3 years ago, it's like 4 years ago, it's like, okay, I'm going to eventually do a Munro round in a self-support style. It's just a matter of when, you know. And I enjoy racing. I enjoy the competitive side of like doing long distance races as well. But because I've been running for so long now, it was like I needed a break from it. And I thought, well, 2020 was going to be a good year to take a break from it. It's turned out to be a great year because there's been no races on. when I decided last year that COVID wasn't a thing. So yeah, it's kind of like, it is what it is, I suppose. So yeah, it's...
Yeah, it's worked out, that's for sure. Donnie, how old are you now?
35.
Mate, yeah. aren't you getting too old for this shit? Isn't that what people say to you?
I feel like I'm getting too old for this crap. I've been running since 2009, I think. I've always said, like, when I first got into running in 2009, it wasn't as popular as it is now, like long distance stuff. People said, you know, how long are you going to keep this up for? You know, how long are you going to keep doing this crazy stuff? My answer's always been until I stop enjoying it. You know what I mean? You know, I still enjoy majority of my training. You're not going to enjoy every run. You're not going to enjoy every bit of your training. You're not going to enjoy every race or every adventure. But, you know, if you start not enjoying it and just kind of constantly just kind of like not enjoying it, you're just doing it because that's what you do, then I'd move on, I'd go and do something else. So, yeah, I'm still enjoying it. I'm still enjoying the adventure. I still love just getting running up hills and just going up hills as fast as I can and just being in the outdoors, you know, is a great way to be. And I think I'm very fortunate that I can ski tour as well in winter and getting into cycling. So I can use different sports to go and explore the outdoors. So, you know, if, for example, you know, I'm carrying an injury or I just don't feel like running that day, but kind of fancy, okay, I'll go cycling. And then winter, I'm just looking for any excuse to go ski touring in Scotland when there's weather because it's so much fun, to be honest. So, yeah, it kind of keeps it varied and interesting. But, yeah, just generally like being outdoors and just having fun.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's really is something pretty important to bring up every now and again, because quite often I experience it a bit where, you know, you really do get questioned, you know, like, when are you going to stop? Like, when are you still doing this running business? Like, are you still, you know, when are your knees going to give in and all this stuff? And I feel like, it, you know, it's probably doesn't come from a place where people don't say it, to try and force you out of it. It's probably a place of concern, but I think, you know, we're not going to be able to achieve certain things if we put these like fictitious time limits on ourselves based on our age, you know? And I, as you say, like, why would you want to stop something you enjoy doing, especially if it's not harming anyone, you're getting outdoors and you're able to then pass on that knowledge and help people do it themselves, like you do with your coaching business as well.
Yeah, I think it's just people don't understand what you do and how, but for me as well, like people don't understand what I do and how I make a living, because like they always ask me. And, you know, for a prime example, I remember, I think it was last year, the year before, Dad actually asked me when I was going to get a proper job. He didn't mean it in a bad way. He just had no idea what I do on a daily basis, you know. He just sees me as someone that just goes out running every day and somehow makes a living. But, you know, so it's that kind of thing. I just don't think the majority of people understand like what we do, you know, when we're in the mountains, or, you know, how we make a living from it and how we survive. And that's because a majority of people don't get to experience it. You know, they're brought up in cities. You know, their outdoor experience might be walking up, say, a small hill. So in Scotland, you know, most people's outdoor experience. So, for example, when COVID restrictions lifted, you know, people were flocking to the outdoors to, like, climb Connaught Hill, which is just outside Glasgow, or Ben Lomond, or, you know, the main pass up hills. But they never had gone off the beaten track and looked for some more remote road roads or quiet roads. You know, the majority of people flock to these beauty spots that you can get out of your car, walk 5-10 minutes, take a photo, put it on Instagram and say you're in the outdoors. That's not the outdoors, really. So you're probably the same as well, kind of, for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it is it's certainly a case that I'm always trying to argue. to continue doing what I love doing, which is funny in a way because, that concept of getting a real job does pop up for me as well. And it's just interesting. I just find it so interesting because it's such a, like you say, it's such an uninformed question and an uninformed like statement sometimes as well. And I try to just work at the complete opposite and encourage people to do something that's totally against the grain, because I feel like the way we are, you know, brought up in society in some ways is definitely to fit in with a system that hasn't necessarily served humans as well as it could, you know what I mean? It's there's a lot of people that are not living the life that they could be living, and there's a lot of people that aren't enjoying the life that they're living, and that can be really sad, you know, because there's so many things that can be done in the world, and it doesn't always have to come back to this traditional 9-to-5, do something because you studied in it, not because you love it, work hard, enjoy life later on kind of thing. That could be a whole nother conversation itself, obviously, mate. But so look, this, like you mentioned it before, you know, you do love getting out in hills and you are a professional as well at ultra running and mountain running. Where when did the preparation for this really begin? Like, when did you first get into being someone who was in the outdoors? Is it something that you've done from childhood, or did it come later on in life for you?
I've always enjoyed a sense of adventure, even as a child, you know, kind of playing about on big rocks and stuff like that. But actually my first sport was shinty, which for the Australian listeners is basically a bit like hockey, a bit more violent. The ball's lighter, the ball travels in the air more. And you obviously might be aware of hurling because of American football and Gaelic football. That's a great sport to watch. Like, I love watching it because it's basically just no rules whatsoever. But so shinty's very much like hurling, and we actually have composite rules to play hurling shinty, where you probably have, I don't know if there's any rules where you play Aussie rules against Gaelic football on that. So that was my first sport growing up. But yeah, I was always in the outdoors, like coming from Skye and West Coast of Scotland, you're surrounded by beautiful wildlife. And then, you know, my sense of adventure and kind of wanting to travel a bit and see the world led me into the Marines at 17. So I left school and joined the Marines. So yeah, I've always enjoyed being outdoors. I've always challenged myself physically as well. That's kind of the other thing I kind of enjoy, is seeing how far you can push yourself physically and mentally, like compared to if I want to be good at shinty. So I end up playing for Scotland at under 17 level, going through all the development squads at that. It's just like, I want to go and travel to some crazy places, which is only the dream, but it's not reality. So, you know, I thought, I'll join the Marines, maybe travel to, you know, Everest Base Camp, go to the North or South Pole or something like that. It'd be pretty cool. And I ended up in Iraq in 2003 in the desert. So, yeah, what can you do?
Yeah, mate, that's a whole different world, I'm assuming. Because you joined the Royal Marines when you were 17, is that right?
Yeah, I joined Royal Marines just turned 17, and then I passed out on, so it was November, so basically I turned 18 on November the 21st, and I flew out to the Middle East in January that year to prepare for invading Iraq, really. So yeah, I was probably one of the youngest soldiers in the UK in Iraq at that time. So you had to be 18 to be deployed on a live operation. And I was basically 18 by 2 months when I was getting deployed. So yeah.
Mate, that, I think back to myself when I was 17. How do you look back at yourself? Look back at the person you were when you were 17. Do you feel like you were too young to be in that space, or how did you take on that responsibility?
I think it was a perfect time to be in that space, because when you're young in that age, you always have that kind of air and invincibility. You know, The prime examples, you see it with young people that have just passed the test, like they'll go around corners, they'll drive really fast and thinking, oh, well, I'm invincible on that. And that's kind of just led into, you know, obviously in marine training and stuff, you always just think, it's not going to be me, you know, I'm young, I'm 17, I'm invincible. It never crosses your mind that, you know, you were actually in a dangerous situation. You know, for me, it's like, I was completely fine. I was never worried or ever thought about, you know, this could be it in Iraq. It's more kind of just like, yeah, this is what I do. It's a bit of a cool adventure. I'm stuck in a desert with a bunch of other people. That's kind of, you know, it's probably the right time. Because as you get older, you get more aware of like, you know, oh, what happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? You know, that kind of stuff. Whereas for me at that age, it was just like, yeah, this is pretty cool, something new.
So what, how long were you out there for? How long were you deployed in Iraq for?
I think it ended up being about 4 months. So left UK in January. I remember pretty much leaving and being based in Cyprus for a bit before flying on into Iraq. And then I think it was May. I can't remember. It would have been, May or beginning of June when I eventually came back from Iraq. Maybe 4 or 5 months, I think.
There's certainly a number of examples of ultra runners, trail runners, ultra runners in the community that have had a history within, you know, the military. And I find it super interesting, and it's, you know, it doesn't necessarily always flow over, but, you know, you look at people like your mate Tom Evans. He's got a background in the military, and I don't know, does Jo Meek? I don't know if she does as well. But what do you take from your experience in the military and bring it over to what you do in running and ultra running?
That's a hard question because, you know, for me anyway, I can only speak for myself. I've always been competitive. I'm always kind of wanting to try and push myself physically. So during the Marines, I've seen that as kind of a way of challenging myself. Could I get through their basic training? Could I hack it, on that? So I've always had that determination, kind of wanting to challenge myself. Obviously, being in the Marines, you probably learn a bit more about discipline and kind of harnessing that kind of motivation and stuff. And then obviously having them experiences, you know, being wet and cold for hours at a time, really relates to, you know, running long distance and being wet and cold. And there are the organization skills, like the discipline and the planning, kind of really home in on that, you know. So, especially with like big adventures, you know, really getting into the planning and the logistics is kind of something you might pick up in the military. But, you know, for me, you know, it's also other experiences that helped me, you know, get around them and roll around. It wasn't just because I had a military background. I'd probably say more of my experiences that were useful were my running experiences over the last decade. You know, for example, knowing that I can run for 48 hours before I keel over was useful in the last 2 days. So I ended up running for 48 hours and I knew that was possible because I'd done it previously and stuff like that. And when you go through like a low point or when you kind of mess up your nutrition and you feel rubbish because you haven't eaten and you're basically hypoing, being there in a race or done it in training before, you know, okay, well, I need to slow down, I need to eat, or I need to drink water, I need to do this. You know, them experiences were probably more valuable now than what I'd done in the Marines. But yeah, I'd probably say, you know, having some military background, you know, you kind of have that instilled discipline and kind of perseverance and yet some of the other traits that you come from the military. But it's probably people that have gone into that have then certain traits to be successful. So if you don't, you're not going to pass training. So, you know, it's kind of that catch 22, you know, nurture nature.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I can understand that for sure. I mean, it makes me smile and think, well, now you've got this, now you know that you can do something for 31 days and change. Like, when are you going to be calling upon that to go, oh, well, no worries then. I can go for, you know, 59 days and I'll be sweet. I'm so interested to hear about other examples of moments in your history that you called upon during really tough times for strength. Were there any other things that continually popped up? And it might not have to do with running or racing. Like, was it people from your past that just randomly, you know, gave you motivation when you were out there by yourself?
So I'm kind of stubborn and like proving people wrong. So the schedule I set out was like 33 days. It was very ambitious. Like the way it came about was that I looked at the previous records schedule and what he did in the day. I went, okay, what can I do on one day in training? So for example, day three, I combined two of his days, which was like 14 in rows, and they ended up being like 64K with 5,500 meters of ascent. He took 2 days to do that. I knew I could do that as a day standalone in training. I went and did it in training just to see how I'd feel afterwards on that. So, you know, that's kind of how I thought. It's like, okay, what can I do on any given day in training? Not back to back, but just, you know, as a long run, as in like, what can I physically do? And I just did that for trying to link all of my rows together without giving myself more work by coming out of a range to go back in. And I worked out at 33 big days, most of them really big 12-hour, 14 days. And the big question mark over that was that possible? I had no idea. Like, I knew, give me any one of them days in the schedule as a standalone day, and I'd be able to do it. Maybe a long day, but I'd be able to do it. The question was, could I do it consecutively? And obviously, some people, I shared the schedule with, and some people were like, yeah, that's crazy. No way. That's not possible. That's kind of my motivation then during the rounds, like, okay, people don't think this is possible. Let's prove them wrong on that. That's kind of one of the key motivators. And then also, you know, I went to uni and studied sports coaching development. So I know a fair bit about sports psychology and kind of, you know, breaking things down. So trying not to focus on, you know, I've got like 14, 15 days to go until I'm at the finish. More like, okay, let's just focus on the next Monroe, or let's just take one day at a time. And that was key to being successful in these incredibly long multi-day things. Because if you kind of look at the overall picture, you just get bogged down. You just don't see an end in sight. And I did lose focus in one of the days where all I could see was just like 14 days of suffering and no enjoyment. Because I'd lost focus of, you know, just taking a day at a time, a Monroe at a time. That psychology and goal settings, that kind of breaking it down into smaller chunks, and then, you know, positive self-talk, you know, trying to tell yourself you're enjoying it, or, you know, kind of saying, okay, I feel strong, I feel good on that. So these wee tips and tricks kind of help as well. On that, back to your original question of experiences, I wouldn't say there was any specific experiences that I drew on at any low points. You know, for example, when I went for the last 2 days, I combined the last like 3 or 4 days into 2 days and went for 48 hours straight. I knew I'd done that previously when I ran from Glasgow to Skye, or when I attempted the tour last year. I knew I could go 48 hours without very little or no sleep. Whether I could do it after 29 days was another question, but I knew I'd been there previously on that. And again, I think, you know, sometimes being wet and cold, you know, okay, well, I've been wet and cold before. How do I warm up? What do I do? You know, how far do I take it? You know, simple things like, okay, when do I put my waterproof jacket on? You know, that kind of situation. You know, it comes with experience. You know, like, okay, it looks like it's going to get a heavier rain. I'm getting a bit cold. Maybe now might be the right time to put the jacket on, et cetera, et cetera. So it just comes with experience.
Yeah. It is amazing how it's sometimes it can be hard to believe until you experience it, and then you're like, oh yeah, how did I not see that last time? And then, you know, that reminds me of my experience at UTMB in 2017, and I dropped out of that race, and I look back now and I'm just like, oh, why did I just not put my jacket and my pants on earlier? Not like my actual like long pants, as opposed to, I had shorts on obviously, but I think you guys call them trousers, don't you? I always get that. Yeah. That got me so much.
You're running the UTMB naked, but naked.
Yeah, I was like, no wonder I got cold and wimped off the course. But Yeah, no, like, and I look back now, I'm just like, oh God, like, why did I just didn't have that experience. I just didn't know better. And yeah, like you say, it's, you've just got to go through it sometimes and it really sticks with you. Well, it's cool that you mentioned the tour because myself and obviously Robbie, we've had some really good experience at the tour, being there to support people, obviously supporting Nats, which is just an amazing experience. How was your experience out there? And for anyone who doesn't know, that the tour is Tour de Gens, which is a race in Italy. It's like 300. It's interesting. It's like 338 kilometers with like 30,000 meters of elevation all the way through the Aosta Valley, an incredible part of the world. And one of those events that is really iconic on the global stage. So what happened with your experience out there?
Didn't go to plan, so to say. I ended up pulling out about halfway. Again, this comes back to psychology and preparation. Like, so, you know, going into the tour, I was like really organized. I prepared things. I was like, okay, it's going to hurt. You know, what am I going to do if this happens? What am I going to do if that happens? You know, kind of thinking of strategies, planning for things to go wrong. So you had things to put it right. So for example, you know, what happens if I feel nauseous after 24 hours? What should I do? And, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, I could try a possible sleep or stuff like that. So, you know, I prepared all that and I thought of everything, you know, what if this gets injured, what if that gets injured? So the tour started and, you know, prime example of preparing stuff like that, you know, I went off a bit too quick because I had no idea how to pace it. It was my first time and I thought, okay, I'll just go with like the people had done it before. So a lot of the front runners had done it before and done well. And that's kind of where my ambition was. I was like, oh, well, they know what they're doing. I felt nauseous after like 12, 13, 14 hours. So actually coping strategy, ready for it. It's like, okay, I'll take a half hour nap on the first night so I can start eating again. And I did that. The thing I didn't think I would get was exercise and induced asthma. So never had asthma in my life, never had exercise induced asthma, but you know, start of Sunday. Yeah, I was going into Monday morning, like I was struggling to breathe and just coughing lots. And it just kind of progressively got worse to the point like I literally couldn't breathe. You know, I remember just before pulling out, like I tried to run and I had to stop. And it must be like what an asthma attack is, because I'm just kind of going, I can't breathe. And you start panicking because you can't breathe and that doesn't help on that. But, you know, maybe if I had prepared mentally that I might get asthma, I might have thought of a way of coping with it or slowing down or accepting it. But because I hadn't, then I ended up dropping out halfway. I can't remember where I dropped out. So it didn't go well on that. But again, it's a learning curve. I learned from these mistakes. You know, if I ever went back and did it, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to prepare for that. You know, to the point that for the Monroe round, I got a prescription for an inhaler because after when I pulled out of the tour, I end up having to go to hospital and get checked over because I was still struggling to breathe. And they diagnosed it with bronchitis and exercise induced asthma. So I got that letter and went and seen my sports medicine doctor back in the UK. And I was like, okay, what do I do to, you know, limit this happening again in a race? Or, you know, what happens if it can? And it's like, well, you can take this inhaler. And then my first question was, is it not a banned substance? It's like, no, not if you take less the dose than this and only use it when you need to. So, you know, kind of that thing. It's like, okay, well, that's what I know I can do now when I go back to the tour. Or, you know, for example, I had it in the sport vehicle for the Monroe round, but never needed it because I never had that asthma again. On that, and then, you know, as you probably do as well, like as you're in the UTMB, you look back and you kind of go, okay, where did things go wrong? What could I have done better? And you're kind of saying, well, I should have put my pants on earlier and stuff like that. And, you know, looking back into the tour, it's like, what could I do next time on that? And why did I get exercise and just an asthma? And the only reason I can think of was the altitude, the cold air, and starting the race with a slight virus, because I wasn't 100% on the start line. I had picked up a cold from my wife the week before. And they were the only things that were kind of really different that from normal races. Like I've ran at altitude in the cold before. I ran up Kilimanjaro, ran up Mount Kenya, and never had any issues. So So I think it was a combination of that. But yeah, that was my tour experience. Definitely won't go back. Like, it's a beautiful route, as you're saying. And like, it's bonkers elevation. But, you know, it's such a fun community. And obviously you and Rob's, I've experienced it quite a few times supporting Nats and stuff. So yeah, it's a pretty cool place to be.
Yeah, it really is. Like, it's so wild, and just the community around it is it's so fun to be a part of. I can't really explain it any other way. Hanging out in a sports hall at 4 a.m. in the morning, just helping people, you know, come in and feed them. And yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those things I look back on and realize that, you know, the community of running and the sport of running is so much more and so much bigger than just the activity itself. Yeah. So it's pretty special.
I think that's the thing with the tour and a lot of other races. It's not just the runners that makes it special. It's the spectators, it's the sport crew. You know, another one that stands out for me in that is Transvolcania. It's like bonkers. What makes the race isn't the runners. It's actually the people like supporting and helping out and stuff. So, you know, people think racing is quite an individual sport, but actually when the communities get involved, it's, you know, it's a big community sporting event, and it's great. And Tours is a prime example of that, where each region and each kind of, you know, refuge is all on board. They're like really happy to see you and stuff. So it's great.
It's incredible. What was your experiences like when you were doing Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya? You know, such a different culture, such a different country. How did you navigate those kind of expeditions?
So I've always liked traveling, and I like using running as a method of traveling and seeing things. You know, when you're running, you get to see things a bit more, and actually it's easier to interact with the locals. You know, my ideal holiday is actually traveling somewhere remote and actually experiencing what the locals do or how the locals live, rather than going sitting on a beach resort somewhere or, you know, on that. So when I went to Africa, Kenya, I went with a mate, Dr. Andrew Murray, and basically went out with like a couple of goals. I have a good time, do a bit of running. So we ran like 17 consecutive ultra marathons around Kenya, and did a speed ascent of Kilimanjaro, Mount Kenya, and then also went to Eton to kind of study what makes Kenyans such good long-distance runners. Being a doctor, a sports medicine doctor, he was keen on that kind of side of stuff, and I was interested. So we kind of, you know, interviewed a few people like Brother Colum and a few other top athletes, and kind of tried to kind of get into knowing what makes Kenyan runners so great. Basically, the feedback is it's basically a load of different things. It's, you know, it's environmental. It's, you know, one of the prime examples is like genetics plays a part, their altitude plays a part, but also, you know, people in Kenya look at long distance running as a way of getting out of poverty, whereas in the West, people look at university as getting out of poverty, that kind of side of stuff. And then also success breeds success. So, you know, Brother Colum's comment, it's quite fascinating at times, like, okay, so why is British cycling so good in the 90s and stuff like that? Why is there a lot of good boxers come from the Bronx in New York? You know, why do Kenyans have such good? Because competition breeds competition within that area. So success breeds success. So, yeah, it's kind of that kind of side of stuff. And then also, you know, other factors played a part, and that was what the conclusion was. So it wasn't just one bit. It wasn't just like you got it, which they, or it wasn't because they trained at altitude. It wasn't because they came from this tribe, that was genetics. It was kind of like everything had played its part in making them really good long-distance runners. Back to your actual original question. Sorry for going off on this tangent. So kind of running up Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya, it was fairly straightforward. Like, you know, people have images of Africa being completely out there and remote, but especially Kenya, it's kind of fairly westernized to a certain extent. You know, the British Army got training camps over there. actually who I was with, Andrew Murray, who was brought up in Kenya, spent for missionary doctors in Chogoria, which was also another eye-opener. Like, we actually went to Chogoria and seen the Chogoria Community Hospital, and actually seeing that hospital just opened my eyes to how privileged we are, and, well, how privileged I am in Scotland with the NHS. And, you know, people give our healthcare a bad time, but then you go to, like, Kenya and you just see how basic it is out there. And again, Chogoria is probably one of the better hospitals in Kenya as well. So it's that kind of thing, you know, it makes you appreciate what you've got after being to these environments and seeing how other people live, and you kind of appreciate coming home to, you know, a nice house, central heating, you know, and all that kind of side of stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, like, what, with all that you saw out there in regards to, you know, the long distance communities in Kenya and Iten, you know, like, what have you taken from those experiences and applied to your own success as a runner? Knowing that, yeah, you don't have certain elements that you did mention, like the altitude, like the, I'm not saying that you don't have the genetics, Donnie, but like, just like the, you know what I mean when I say that,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But yeah. Like, what have you taken from the knowledge you picked up there and applied to your athletic life since those times? And also, I'd love to know how you've applied that to your coaching as well.
I think the key thing for me, and a lot of people underrate it in Western society, is sleep and rest. People think being able to get by on 4 hours sleep is like, great, I'm really strong, like, look at me, I can get by on four or six hours sleep. And I've coached people who said, like, yeah, I only need 6 hours sleep to do this and this and this. And you're like, well, you know, have you tried 8 hours sleep? You know, you might actually be more productive with more sleep, you know. The Kenyans are like sleeping champions. Like, I'm sure if sleeping was a sport at the Olympics, they would excel at it. Like, incredible. They can sleep for like 12 hours to get up. They run in the morning, come back, they sleep, they eat, and they train again, and then they sleep. So, you know, it's like, it's hard for, you know, someone that holds down a normal job or a job or other jobs to be able just to, you know, get up, eat, train, sleep, eat, train, sleep. You know, that's not realistic, but how can you apply some of them principles to my life or my athletes? It's kind of like you get them to realize that sleep is probably one of the most important things in training, because that's when your body actually recovers the most. So obviously, if you do a hard training session, but then you're working like 8-12 hours a day, and then you kind of want to do other stuff, and you're only getting 6 hours of sleep, you've only got 6 hours of recovery time, whereas if you got eight hours of recovery time, you're going to recover better for the next day, so you're going to train better. You'll reduce your risk of injury and stuff like that. So I think one of the biggest things here is, and I see a lot of my athletes, is they undervalue the importance of sleep and rest and kind of also switching off, because we live in a society where there's information overload. You've got emails coming in whenever you want them on, like, your smartphones. You know, you can pretty much find out any information you want whenever you want at a touch of a button. So there's no time to switch off mentally either, where in Kenya, it's pretty much their life revolves around running. When they're not running, they're either eating or lying in the grass sleeping. And, you know, if they're hanging out with their friends, they're talking about running, or it's completely immersed into their society. I'm not saying that's the way we should go over here, but I'm just, you know, I think people having time away from technology, away from screens, and just kind of connecting with nature and just having time to switch off mentally and rest and recover make a massive difference to a lot of people's training. And that's kind of what I focus on as well. It's like trying to actually, you know, especially when I was training for the Monroe round, I was doing like 20, 25 hours of training. I'm really focusing on, you know, sleeping. So trying to get minimum 8 hours sleep a night, even trying to get 10 hours sleep a night if possible. And it's not like I sleep for any length of time. I'm a terrible sleeper, but just lying down with my eyes closed and not staring at a phone or, you know, that kind of thing, or watching TV. So I think that's kind of one take home things from Kenya.
That's super valid. Hey, yeah, you know, I tell you what, Robbie would challenge the Kenyans for a good sleep competitor, that's for sure. Made us a pro at it. And it's all for good reason. It's all intentional as well, as you say. It's it's like the most, you know, it's like the rest day, you know, that that classic, yeah. The rest day is like the most important training day of the week.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. How much time were you able to, well, being like on the Munro round that you did, that did you, like, you obviously spent a lot less time connected to the, I guess, like the outside world and yeah. like you were mentioning before on your phone and things like that. How did that affect you, or how did you notice a change in your own kind of, I suppose, mental state after so long being in a completely different routine?
It was great, like, because obviously I was doing it just post-COVID lockdown and there's still a lot of COVID in the news. And then again, also in the UK, we get a lot of Brexit news as well about leaving the European Union. It was actually nice just to not hear any of that. You know, I could have been anywhere. The COVID could not have existed. You know, I was very rarely reminded of COVID unless I was cycling past the town and I seen someone walking about with a face mask on, or that, because I didn't have to go to the shops. I was in the hills all the time, and I didn't really, you know, I didn't have time to look at news when I got in, and wasn't really that fussed for looking at news anyway when I got in. So yeah, it was kind of great to disconnect. You know, you don't miss it to a certain extent. I've been in a few environments like that. So I remember going to China last year, and the internet out there censored, so my phone wouldn't pick up any internet. So I didn't pick up emails for like almost a week out there, and no social media, nothing. And it was like really nice. I enjoy it, you know, that kind of disconnecting. Even, you know, it's great to even, you know, in training, just taking the camper van away and going parking in a spot you don't have a phone signal overnight, and then getting up the next morning and going running. It's just, you know, it's just a nice way to live. Obviously, it's not sustainable for a business or that, but, you know, yeah, I really enjoy that kind of time where it's kind of like, yeah, I'm not spending as much time on social media. I don't have to worry about it. Obviously, I've been social media posts during the round, and I've read some comments on it. But, you know, yeah, it's just kind of, I really enjoy disconnecting to a certain extent.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I know, you know, like a lot of people that are in a similar age bracket to yourself and myself recently have said, you know, I've really stopped using social media. And this, you know, there's like the, there's a documentary that came out recently, The Social Dilemma, which speaks a lot to its use and yeah, things like that. Yeah, you know, and it's so interesting because sometimes when using social media and being connected to email and stuff, it doesn't seem like it's such a negative thing. Like it doesn't really have like a really intense negative sensation associated with it. But it's when you step away from it completely, when you realize there's almost this air of lightness and you're just not thinking a lot about it, or yeah, it just doesn't take up a lot of that mental energy. And you're like, oh, wow, I'm not noticing how much it has a negative effect, but when I don't have it, I just realize that's when I really realize how much of a positive it is to step away sometimes. I don't know why I felt drawn to say that, but I just feel like it's so interesting how we don't notice it until it's gone sometimes. And I think if there's anything I would encourage people to do is probably do what you did. Firstly, go and do something like a Munro round, but then secondly, to use it as a good excuse to step away for some social media and the connected world, essentially.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like I listened to a podcast, I think it was Mark Bowman, was saying about, you know, you should try at least, they're talking about people getting into cycling and doing endurance cycling. And one of his comments was, you know, he was comparing when he first cycled around the world when there was no social media and stuff, and then to when he cycled like the Americas and stuff, and he was like posting on Twitter every other day and having kind of feedback and sharing it. And he's like, you know, actually, you know, people should go and do like a big run or a big cycle and actually intentionally not take any photos and not post it on social media, because that's kind of, you know, a really nice way of going. It kind of, you're not doing it for kudos or, you know, bragging about on social media, you're just doing it for yourself. And it's kind of nice doing that. And I do that quite often, you know. Yeah, I'll post some runs in training, or, you know, I'll post a nice photo now and again, but there's a lot of training that I'll do and not bother taking a photo or anything like that or posting about it, because can't be bothered. To be honest with you, it's like, I do it for me. I enjoy being out. I don't feel the urge that I have to share, you know, every long run I do or every hill I've climbed. You know, it's kind of nice not to.
Yeah.
And for me personally, when I'm doing stuff on social media, making posts, it does feel like work. You know, obviously I've got a business, I've got, you know, sponsors and stuff like that. So I do feel like, you know, I might do one social media post a week or something like that. Or if I'm doing stuff like Monroe Round on, and I'll do a social media post, that actually feels like work. Doesn't feel like work taking the photos. It feels like work editing the photos and then putting a comment. And I'm like, okay, what should I write? What should I do? You know, that kind of stuff. Whereas it'd be just nice to take a couple of photos for your own use, finish your run, have some food, chill out in the evening and not have to worry about anything like that. You know, when you put it like that, as you're saying, you feel more liberated. You don't feel like it's using your energy, because it does use your energy when you're having to kind of get creative and put a post up or something like that, where you can just chill out and not have to look at your phone.
Absolutely. I feel like there is a direct connection there as well with recording your events. You know what I mean? Like, so many people say, oh, I need to use my watch and I need to record my training so I can look back at it, et cetera, which is totally fine. But I find it so interesting if you forget to press start, or you press pause and you forget to press start again on your run, or your battery drops out. This whole other sense of engagement you have with your run sometimes. It's like, oh, this isn't getting recorded. Like, and that whole saying of like, if it's not on this platform, it didn't happen, like, creeps in. And I'm like, and I've spoken about this with a number of people and they say the same thing. It's just like, hang on, it is happening. It is training. Like, you are doing something. Don't be fooled into believing that because it's not recorded on some device and stored somewhere, it didn't happen, because it's such a funny thing to think that way. Yeah,
it's funny. And one of the things as a coach, I try and get some athletes to do, where they get really obsessed by numbers and stuff, is, you know, just stepping stone is actually wear a long sleeve top or wear a buff over your watch. So you're still recording it, but you're not like looking at your watch while you're running. And just get some disconnect between technology. I've been able to run more by feel than having to like look at their watch, you know, to confirm what heart rate they're in, how hard they're working, or what pace they're running. It's more like, okay, run by feel, let's see how it feels. You know, listen to your body. Your body's your best source for feedback. You know, your brain will tell you how you're feeling and how hard you can push. You don't need technology to tell you that. And it's kind of one of the ones I tell athletes now and again that are struggling with that, is they're like, okay, don't mind you wearing a watch, don't mind you recording it because it's training data, but, you know, cover it with a buff or put a bit of tape over it for the entire run. So if you do look at it, you can't see the numbers and you just run by feel. I think it's a really good bit of advice to try. And as you say, you know, it doesn't have to be on Strava to count as training.
Yeah, no, absolutely, mate. It definitely doesn't. That's actually like the physics of that is completely wrong. like scientifically, it's impossible, actually. So let's just make that very clear. Hey, mate, I wanted to ask you about this moment that I did see a bit of footage, speaking of content, from your Munro round. It was very insightful, and it was it made me very curious, because it was on, I believe it was on day 17, and you took some, and you probably know exactly what I'm speaking about.
Yeah.
And you're coming down this, you're filming yourself and you're coming down. It seems like you're coming down to Munro, and you're just like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, what is the point of this? All I'm doing every day is running up and down hills for 12 to 14 hours, and I'm just beating myself up. And what's the point of it? Tell me. And you also referred to, you know, you've got at least 17 more days to go and you're not enjoying it. And I want to know a couple of things about that. Firstly, how did you get through that? What was the process you went through to take yourself out of that train of thought? And also, yeah, what was it all for? Like, what did you end up, what was the conclusion to that question?
Deal. So the reason that video came about, first of all, I have my hands up, but Simon Willis, who was filming for the Adventure Show, said at the start of the round, you know, to get some good footage, when you don't want to film, when you least want to film, please get your phone out or get the GoPro out and film, because this will be the best footage. So that's why the camera came out at that very point. I was in a really bad place. And kind of coming back to, you know, the questions previously, you know, obviously focus in your sports psychology. And as I mentioned, hinted at earlier, I said I lost focus on one or two days where all I can see is the bigger picture. And that's what had happened. So day 17, so far in, so I've been running for 17 days and I've just done like massive big days, like 12, 14 hour days consecutively. And I was feeling pretty beaten up. Like I had right anterior pterygoid tendinopathy in the first, well, just after the first week, which was really sore, and managed to get on top of that. But it was inevitable my left would go because I was overcompensating my left side. And day 17 was when my left went and started getting sore halfway through day 17. So it's kind of like a snowball effect. You know, there's lots of things not going as I wanted them to go or seen them go. So obviously for 3 or 4 days I was kind of in a fairly negative space, and I said it interviewed at the top of Ben Lomond. It's like, yeah, I'm just getting annoyed, I'm not going as fast as I thought I should be going. And you know, I was just not, I was still moving well, but I was just kind of like, you know, I was trying to figure out when I was going to get an easier day, and I couldn't see an easier day. So I was losing focus already on one day at a time, one minute at a time. I was starting to look, yeah, I need an easy day. I need a day where I can finish maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and get catch up some sleep and catch up and just some rest. Because I was constantly doing like 16, 14, 12 hour days. And I was just really busy because it was like around the central belt. So it was like around Ben Lomond. That's where it was really busy. So like wife Rachel was kind of stress of the driving, finding parking spaces, etc., and that. So there's lots of kind of background going into that. And again, coming back to mental preparation, like I knew the middle of the round was going to be the hardest mentally because you're so far away from the start, but yet you're so far away from the finish. You've been doing it for so long, you've pushed your heart, body so far, and you're just like running on empty, but yet, you know, if you take your head up and look at how far you've got to go, it's 14, 17 days. It's massive. It's like still not even halfway or that. On that, so that's kind of the background coming into day 17. And yeah, kind of, I was actually enjoying day 17 in the morning. Like it was a great morning, really nice morning, some nice views. I was moving well, but then halfway through the day, I kind of, things started slowing down. My left ankle got sore, and I knew the time I was hoping to finish at was getting further and further away. And then I was like, this is rubbish. And like every Monroe I was doing, so I was coming over Monroe, and for some reason I had mentally thought next Monroe's not too far away, and they were so far spread out. I was like, oh, this is rubbish. I'm not getting to this Monroe. And by the time I got to the second last Monroe, I really did think it was just a little drop down and then up onto the Monroe, and I just came over it. I was like, I think I look back now and I checked on the map, it was like maybe 4 or 5K away, and I thought it was only going to be a couple of K and quite a big drop down. And I was just like, that was it. That was the trigger. It's like, I was being honest, I wasn't enjoying it. I was in pain, as you could tell by the video. And I started asking questions like, why am I here? You know, what is the point of running up and down hills? You know, there's no, it's not benefiting anyone, if you know what I mean. There's no zero benefits from it to the world or anything like that. It's kind of a selfish thing to be doing, you know, on that. So I was just honest on the camera. That's how I was feeling at that very precise moment. I was like, well, I'm not enjoying it. What's the point? And I'd lost focus, as I said. You know, I was thinking about, I've got another 14 days or 15 or 16, 17 days until I've finished. On that, and then I got back to the van that night. So I finished the day. And just moaned to my wife Rachel again, just like exactly the same thing. I want to go home, you know, I could just go home now. But it was never a question of I would go home, because even at that point, I was 2 days up in the record at least on that. So, like, there was no reason to go home. I could have actually slept for 2 days and then carried on and still potentially broken the record. But that's how I was feeling. And I think it was a way of coping with how I was feeling, was just sharing it and just accepting that I was in a bad place. and I said this in previous interviews, you know, my job at the time and my routine at the time was get up at 5 a.m., out of the van by 6 and run or walk or crawl. So it wasn't day 18 came, even though I was probably still not 100% enjoying it. I was like, this is what I do. You know, it's like a job, you know, you have a bad day in the office or a really bad day in the office. You don't necessarily quit your job and that's it, not going back. You'll go home, you'll complain, you'll be in a grump, but you'll get up the next day and you go to work. And you just pick away at it. And that's what I did, you know. So on day 18, I moved things about because of my ankle. So instead of having like a really another massive day, I still had a fairly big day, but involved a bit more cycling on that. So it broke up just one complete big day of running to a day of like, I did 6 Munros on day 18, but there was a cycling between each two. So I'd do 2 Munros cycle, do 2 Munros cycle. So it broke it up rather than doing a big massive day. So that's kind of like this thing of kind of trying to manage my left ankle on that and just kind of focusing on, okay, what can I do to get on top of this injury? Focus on, you know, the way I moved it about is I ended up doing Anahiga, which, you know, you've covered the Skyline Race before. And it's good running. It's not like trips and through bog. You get nice views and it's a bit more technical to take your mind off it. So that kind of really gave me a boost mentally. And I actually look forward to Anahiga because I've done it before and it's kind of the style of running I like, where it's a bit more technical, it's a bit more interesting. You've got to think a wee bit more about where you're putting your feet, where you're putting your hands, which takes your mind off how sore your ankle is, how tired you are, and how far you've got to go. So, yeah, that's kind of how I got through it, you know, kind of routine, discipline, maybe come back from the Marines. And again, I really cared about climbing all the Munros in Scotland, so I was really highly motivated and passionate about it. Then to answer your question about why, is there any point of running up and down hills? Yeah, there's probably 0 point, you know, like, you know, I enjoy it. It's great. Don't get me wrong. It's great to break a record, but you know, it hasn't changed anything. It hasn't cured COVID. You know, I haven't cured poverty or anything like that. I haven't benefited anyone else. I might have inspired a few people to get out in the hills, which was great. But yeah, for me, it's just enjoyment and just seeing how far I can push myself physically. And thankfully I had a team behind me because it was a big team effort that let me try and push them boundaries on that. So it's a fairly selfish kind of aspiration on that, but yeah, that's my answer.
Fair enough, man. Yeah, it's I don't know if sometimes I try to eke out the meaning of life from some of my guests. Sometimes it's just not there, and nor should it be. Like, it's, you know, good on you for going after something. I think you probably inspired inspired a lot more people. And also educated a lot more people than you realize as well. You know, like, it's you just don't know how, with all the way the digital world works, how far your example goes and who does see it. You may never even know, and you may never even hear from those people that it does affect, but I'm sure it does get out there, mate. That's 100% for sure. Was that your toughest time out there? Was that your lowest point?
Yeah, so that was my lowest point mentally, which was also the lowest point because the brain is a massive component in any of this. And like, when your brain's kind of not on the same page as where you want to be to a certain extent, yeah, mentally it was the toughest day. Physically, it wasn't the hardest day. And I didn't feel kind of physically totally beaten up at the end of that day, where there was other days where I just like, physically I was completely smashed, but my head was in the game then, so it wasn't as bad. So yeah. When my head wasn't in the game, yeah, it was the toughest day. But, you know, one of the toughest physical days was Noidart. Like, the weather was pretty Scottish, so it was like horizontal rain and really windy, and it was like 64K with 6,000 meters of ascent. It took me 14 and a half hours. And Rachel said, I got back to the van, I was just completely just busted. Like, I just looked a shell. But it was fine. Like, in the weird sense, I was kind of enjoying it because I was pushing myself physically, and I was like, this is really hard, but I was motivated. Like, I'd got that motivation back, and I was kind of like determined. I was just like, yeah, this is hard, but physically I was completely smashed.
Unreal, mate. is that out of all the times you've ever, you know, because you've pushed yourself to some personal physical limits, is that the lowest that you can remember in terms of the physical side of things? Or have you felt more of a skeleton or a shell of a human than that time before?
I think that's probably out there because I ended up having to drop a few minutes the next day. But then again, I don't know, because like obviously I'd ran for 48 hours. Well, didn't run and move for 48 hours in the last 2 days to finish a day ahead of schedule and make the day up I dropped. And I was completely, you know, it was looking me like pretty much knackered. But because it was the finish and you had that adrenaline, I didn't feel completely physically smashed at the end of it. I was like, yes, I finished. Whereas in Noida, I was like, felt completely smashed that night. But I think the mentality was I need to somehow run the next day. Whereas when I finished in Ben Hope after going for 48 hours, like I was probably more physically exhausted, but I hadn't the worry of how do I do this again the next day. I was like, this is done. You had the adrenaline of finishing. So it's hard to answer that question. And same with races. I might have pushed harder in certain races where I really emptied the tank and like crossed the line and completely broke it. Because you're at the finish line, you don't feel as smashed. You're not worrying about, I need to get up and do this the next day or do that the next day on that. So, yeah, probably thinking back, it's probably not the worst state I've been in. I remember finishing Transvolcania and getting carried off to the first aid tent because my body was just constantly cramping and, like, severely dehydrated myself and had to be on an IV drip at the end of that. So, yeah, probably I've been in worse states.
Yeah. And what was the highlight? What was your high moment or your highest moment?
Obviously completing it, but then again, you know, it comes with a tinge of sadness as well because obviously it had been a massive chapter in my life, like 12 months of just focus and planning for this Monroe round and then like 3 or 4 years of wanting to do it. So it's like an end of a chapter on that. But again, it felt great to eventually make Ben Hope and achieve your goal and finish the round and knowing that you didn't have to get up the next day to run more hills. So yeah, that was a kind of a mixed emotion, like more enjoyment and enjoying the fact that I'd finished and achieved it. But yeah, there was a tinge of like, not regret, because I don't regret it, but just more sadness that was that experience over. You know, that was an end of that chapter. I'd done it, I'd been successful on that. Other days that stand out are obviously going home to Skye. The Coolum Ridge is like the most technical bit of the Monroe round. It's very alpine, it's very rocky. And yeah, it was great. I managed to keep my feet dry for the whole day and I had some friends join me and it was blue skies. So yeah, pretty much the only day in summer in Skye because it was blue skies. So yeah, it was like, you know, perfect.
Yeah, that must have been a special time for sure. That part of the world is just, it's like nothing else really. It's incredible.
Yeah, I'm going to be biased, like coming from West Coast Scotland, I think it's up there with one of the nicest parts in the world. Like, I've done a fair bit of traveling and like, the Alps is beautiful and Africa is beautiful. South Africa is beautiful. I've been to Ecuador. Australia is really nice and that. But then you come home to Scotland and you're just like, yeah, it's wet and miserable, but it's still stunning as well.
Yeah, you live in a good part. You live in a good part of the world, mate. There's no doubt about it. And what do they say about? There's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing. Is that a Scottish thing?
I think so. And again, if you live in the west coast of Scotland, if you don't like the weather, just wait 5 minutes. It normally changes anyway. So,
yeah, brilliant, mate. Hey, Johnny. Last thing I want to ask you, mate, is you touched on it quite a few times and it's like the positive psychology of things. And I want to ask, how do you encourage and how do you teach your athletes how to implement positive psychology in their training so that they are able to do it also during their event or during tough times?
That's quite a hard question. I've never really thought about it that way. So for one overarching thing of my coaching philosophy, especially because I coach a lot of amateurs who have full-time jobs and they do it because it's fun, is trying to make training fun. You know, if they're not enjoying training, then what is the point? Or, you know, if training is making it stressful and adding stress to life, then it shouldn't be, because, you know, the majority of them have got full-time jobs that are really stressful. So it should be an outlet for stress. It should be fun. It should be enjoyable. I'm not saying they're going to enjoy all of it. It's not like they're going to enjoy, you know, me giving them a hard hill rip session or that, or, you know, enjoying being out wet and cold on a long run. Obviously, it might be type two fun afterwards. So, you know, it's trying to make it fun for them and, you know, giving them the stuff they like doing on that. So, yeah, enjoyment on that. And then kind of positivity, you know, I talk to my athletes, we chat through like race strategies, you know, I'll ask them what happens if this goes wrong, or, you know, what you plan nutritional wise and stuff on that. But yeah, I think I might have to review my coaching and, you know, actually maybe look a bit more about sports psychology and chat to them a bit more about goal setting and visualization. It's probably an area I probably lacked on. So yeah, thanks for that. So, as a coach, like I speak to Robbie, who's a mutual friend, and, you know, one of the important things is coaching is self-evaluation. And, you know, it's good to get asked these questions. It's good to self-evaluate how you're coaching. And I'll put my hands up. I don't know everything as a runner. I don't know everything as a coach. I'm still developing on that. So yeah, it's something I probably have to go and self-evaluate now, is how am I getting positivity across to my athletes in races? You know, is it something I need to work on with my athletes?
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that seems to come up a number of times when I have conversations either on Stokely or not on this podcast, a bit with people that have done quite, you know, quite incredible, extreme physical missions and endeavors, and the positive psychology visualization, it really is a reoccurring element of how to get through these things. And I feel like, yeah, it's one thing that, you know, we don't often get to learn too much about unless you go and do the self inquiry yourself. So yeah, cool, man. Well, I look forward to hearing an update on that in your coaching philosophy.
Yeah, sure. That's helped. It's something I have to, you know, kind of have to think about and see how I get that across, and just probably just chat to them, you know, just as we've done here. You know, it's just, it's not a science or anything like that. There's no kind of thing, but it's just communication. It's a relationship you have with your athletes. You know, it's a two-way communication. You ask care questions, they ask questions, you know. That's the way it is, I suppose. So, yeah, just kind of.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, like one thing there too is that positive feedback loop, right? And if you've never done it, if it's not like a habit of yours, which is seldomly a habit of many people, it can be quite awkward to do initially. You know, it's almost a lot as well, like something such as self-acceptance and being kind to yourself and self-love, you know, all those things. If you're trying to tell that to yourself and positive psychology, if you're running, you know, and like keeping yourself upbeat and not being too hard on yourself, well, I think it all falls into the same category. That what I'm trying to say is it can be difficult to do, and it can feel strange and it can feel awkward that you're having all these words to yourself that have a really positive outcome. So I think it's something that we need to kind of put out there more as a really beneficial thing to practice, because it's the only way we're going to get there. Hey.
Yeah, totally agree on that. And yeah, it's just kind of, yeah, just, you know, practice and training, you know, just, yeah, it's, again, it's just being open and honest.
Absolutely, mate. Well, Donny, I'm going to let you get on with your day, mate, because I don't know if you're going to go out to train or if you're going to go back to bed. Because
actually going to give Rachel a lift to work and then out for a run, and then I'll try to run, see how the ribs are. They're slowly getting there. So this will be the first day running outside. I managed to run on a treadmill the last couple of days, but yeah, going to check. Test the ribs out.
This is the first time back to it. That's exciting, mate. I look forward to an update on how that is.
Yeah.
To take care of those ribs, my friend, because they are something that will continually come back to remind you that they were unpleasantly bruised for many, many months to come. So take care of those.
Yeah, cheers. Dig, you're in Melbourne as well. And yeah, hopefully get locked down and get on the field sometime soon.
That'd be great, Johnny. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time, mate. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
So thanks for tuning in today, everyone. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Donny, and I hope it inspires an adventure in your own backyard or anywhere else in the world. If you want to find out a little bit more about Donny, you can check him out on his website at getactiverunning.com. You might even be able to pick up a few tips about coaching and about running and covering some extreme distances under your own power. So thanks again for tuning in, and it's really great to have you here and to hear your feedback as always. So please let us know what you think. Keep well, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye for now.